Each stage of a woman's life brings new possibilities, exciting choices, and sometimes difficult challenges. At Astellas, we understand women want solutions that enable a life of continued possibilities. We will work to elevate the conversation around women's midlife health and provide resources that demonstrate our commitment to women's changing healthcare needs during this stage. Women's Health at Astellas, powering possibilities for women in midlife.
Hello, welcome to Mayo Clinic Talks podcast. My name is Dawn Davis. I'm a professor of dermatology and pediatrics at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. I'd like to welcome my friend and colleague, Dr. Carol Cooley, who is joining us today to talk about hormones, hormone regulation, and hormone-driven cancers and sexual health and why that is so important. So Carol, welcome. And would you like to officially introduce yourself to our audience?
I'm Carol Cool, and I'm the director of the Menopause and Women's Sexual Health Clinic here at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, which is so well supported in our division, which is amazing because this is a unique clinic internationally. So we know that women with cancer are underappreciated in terms of their hormones and how they're affected and the outcomes that affect their sexual health and their relationships, to the point that even the Institutes of Medicine are now paying attention to this and actually had a workshop a couple of years ago and looked at all the things that are missing in cancer survivorship, and sexual health was one of them. And there were a couple of studies that were done that looked at over years, how many people felt like they had the correct information about sexual health, and very low amounts of people understood that this was an important part of their cancer survivorship, and they didn't feel like they had adequate information about it.
Well, thank you. That sounds tremendously important. Just so that we can all be on the same baseline and page and understand the terminology, just a couple of things for the listeners. Are we going to be talking specifically about gynecologic and female predominant cancers such as breast, ovarian, uterine, cervical, et cetera? Or will we be talking about all cancers that happen to people who identify as female?
So we can touch on all those cancers, actually, because in our clinic, we get referrals not only for gynecologic cancers, but for breast cancer, for hematologic cancers, for young people that have leukemias and go through bone marrow transplant. I mean, it encompasses all these different cancers and their treatments and how they are affected in different ways. And so our clinic works with all of them.
That's very helpful. And just to be mindful and respectful of the LGBTQIA population, when we talk in general about cancers related to hormones that particularly are more common in people who identify as female or women, breast, uterine, ovarian, and cervical, is there a preferred term for that? Is it, what's the term for that?
So, I mean, the term cisgender is what we know as female because you have female organs, but certainly our population does include women who identify as lesbian and also the trans clinic. I mean, we will have patients that will have seen that have not had their sex reassignment surgery, but they still have their ovaries. And so how are they affected not only by cancers, but just by menopause in general?
Yeah, absolutely. We'll definitely get there. So could you please, just for the audience's knowledge, refresh our minds and on the incidence of cancer in females and specifically estrogen or female hormone related cancers in the population?
Yes. So we all know that breast cancer is right up there at the top as far as incidence and mortality. But the other cancers also are quite prevalent. And if you look at the 2024 statistics that they are anticipating what those cancer statistics are going to look like, it seems like mortality is going down, but there seems to be a higher incidence, 1-2% more than previously in uterine cancers and cervical cancers. And so that's become a focus of how do we prevent these things? And certainly we're hoping with the immunizations now for HPV that we'll begin to see that change.
Yeah, absolutely. And is this more common as women age, or does it have a bimodal distribution? What is the epidemiology of the incidence?
So certainly if you look over the decades, there seems to be a higher incidence of the breast cancers, the gynecologic cancers, but 25% of women who have gynecologic cancers are premenopausal. And those ones that are missed only, and they're the ones that need the hormone therapy the most. And so trying to figure out the safety of hormone therapy in that population becomes very important, because if they don't get hormone therapy, the outcomes could be very difficult, from cardiovascular issues, bone issues, sexual health issues, cognitive issues. So we look at, you know, how many of those women are actually getting hormone therapy. And the statistics are right now about 9% of those patients that really need hormone therapy are getting it.
So let's talk about the practicalities of what happens to the person, and then we can talk about the psychosocial and medical ramifications. So what happens to a patient in practicality after they've had a cancer and they have surgery, radiation, chemo, et cetera? What happens to their physiology?
Okay. So if you're looking at specifically what happens to the estrogen, so certainly with oophorectomies, you know, it's like right away you're missing most of your estrogen, 40% of your testosterone. So that's certainly going to affect your libido. So if they're getting chemotherapy, if they're getting radiation, it does affect the granulosa cells in the ovary. And so that puts them at higher risk for going into menopause prematurely. So what are the ramifications of lack of estrogen? So depending on your age too, you know, if you're younger, it's been very clear that the research says, you know, women who don't get hormone therapy in those ages under 40, under 45, and even under 50 will have increased cardiovascular outcomes that are detrimental. They have more dementias early on, especially with the ovaries. If those are taken out, they will have anxiety that they may never have had before. But all of a sudden, they will experience anxiety. And then, of course, bone health and osteoporosis, which has huge ramifications or predictions as they age.
Yeah, well, that all sounds quite intimidating. And our topics today are kind of focusing on sexual function or sexual dysfunction with regards to this podcast series. I can imagine that if your hormones just crash and the levels go down, including testosterone, right? I think we all logically understand that estrogen goes down, but it's helpful to know that testosterone also goes down and the implications of that. So how common after cancer is sexual dysfunction, and is it a guarantee that you're going to get it? Is it essentially something that every woman should anticipate?
So if you compare it to the general population, it's higher. So breast cancer is higher. You're looking at maybe up to 90% of breast cancer patients. If you look at cancers across the spectrum, the statistics have been 90% of people will have some kind of sexual health issue if they have a cancer. So looking at, you know, how do we reach out to these people and help them have the conversation becomes really important, because they're not going to bring it up. I mean, in the midst of their treatments and all the anxiety around their life and their stress about, you know, am I going to live? Am I going to die? What's going to happen to me? That kind of gets missed in the population. So even the Institutes of Medicine is saying, hey, you need to be asking this question all along their treatment so that they feel at least comfortable in knowing that that's on the table. That's something that can be discussed, because they're not bringing it up. And certainly what's happening with their partners becomes a really important aspect of this.
Yeah, we talk about traditional vital signs and the non-traditional or new vital signs, pain, for example, quality of life, social determinants of health. And this appears like it might be a non-traditional but very vital sign for these patients. Let's talk about the psychosocial, bigger picture, whole person care. Like you mentioned, they've had a cancer diagnosis, all the guilt and worry and just life practicalities of how that's a curveball at you and your family unit. And probably, I imagine there's a lot of embarrassment, guilt, or shame about the diagnosis. And then maybe perhaps feeling awkward that of all things to worry about your sexual health, you might not feel like that's like to be worthy of your time and attention. And so I appreciate you bringing this to the forefront. And I also appreciate you talking about the impact on the family unit and also the partner. So can we talk about what you do in the office with regards to whole person care and approach to these patients? And then we'll go through specific medical approaches.
Sure. When we're talking to the patient who has cancer, we're looking at what's happening from a hormonal standpoint. Are you having vasomotor symptoms and how we can treat those, whether they can have hormone therapy, or is this a patient that it would be contraindicated and we would use non-hormonal therapy? So that's one aspect. But then we always look at the question of, you know, what's happening? Are you having sexual health issues? And you know, yesterday I gave a talk to the gynecologic oncology group and said, asking the patient, there are screening tools that you can use to identify what those issues are, but you can just ask the patient and just say, you know, when people have this kind of cancer, oftentimes they will have sexual health issues. Are you having any of these issues? And that kind of prompts the conversation and opens up the opportunity. So we'll ask that question as well. Libido is a big deal. And so just understanding their drive and accepting that this is part of what's happening to them and why. And so we have a really nice model called the Bassan model that's been published widely. And we use that to help the patient kind of navigate through, and they can self-identify what it is specifically that's bothering them. So we discuss, you know, what's happening when you are having sexual activity, just to kind of get at how are they functioning? Are they able to lubricate naturally? Are they feeling aroused? Are they having orgasm or not? And once we get past that, even if they're functioning well, there still need be that drive that is diminished and why, and helping them understand that. So in that model, there are specific domains of sexual dysfunction. And so we look at, you know, what are the things that can drive it from a physiologic standpoint? And certainly cancer is one of them. But the other physiologic things are fatigue and loss of hormones. And that's part of it. And then also we look at, you know, what are the psychosocial, emotional, you know, are they depressed? You'd be amazed how many women have been sexually abused. And this comes up. I had a patient who gynecologic oncology sent for a virtual visit before she had her surgery because she had melanoma of the vulva. At the end of the day, it was like, I'm petrified that I'm going to have a recurrence and flashback of my sexual abuse. So we were able to help her navigate through that. As soon as her surgery was over, she came back in. We had her set up with psych. We had her set up with our sex therapist. She was good. You know, it was just the opportunity to talk about it. Sometimes really helps them navigate through those stresses and work with their fears. Certainly, you know, are they using alcohol as a way of managing things and having that discussion about what's happening with that? Because that certainly can increase your hot flashes and certainly worsen your mood issues. You know, and then what's happening with the partner? That is a huge piece and oftentimes overlooked. You know, as a geriatrician, and so I'm trained in geriatrics as well. You know, when somebody has dementia, we have caregiver stress. You know, and we talk with the partners and help them navigate things. Well, the same thing with this, with the sexual health issues. And that's where, you know, after we see them, working with our sex therapist becomes really important, because you can bring in the partners, whether it's male, female, or whatever, and then discuss how, what's happening for them in the relationship, because that support part becomes really important, but you want to support both. And so, and then the cultural things. I mean, we oftentimes will go back and people have learned things about sex, you know, don't talk about it or don't dare get pregnant, you know, those kinds of things. And looking at those taboos that they have learned about sexual activity, it's like a whole new world. And this gets brought into the mix of cancer, you know, and so how do you help them navigate that? You know, some of them will say, no, I really shouldn't be talking about sex. And so we try to normalize and we're like, well, this is the sexual health clinic. You can say anything here. And they're like, phew. You know, so they begin to relax, begin to open up. And you'd be surprised how many people are so appreciative, like, this was the best consult, you know, because they can talk about it and feel comfortable about it and not work embarrassed.
Well, I think you bring up several great points, Carol. Firstly, that it's okay to talk about sex, and that it's okay to talk about sex with your physician, and that when you're with your healthcare professional, that it is a confidential and trusted environment, and establishing rapport with the patient so that you can have sensitive conversations is so important. So thank you. Secondly, it doesn't surprise me at all that you people feel relieved in your clinic because you're such a fabulous clinician. But I'm glad that you mentioned psychiatry and sex therapists, because I don't want our healthcare colleagues who see these women, regardless of their training or specialty, to feel like, oh, I'm supposed to be an expert in this. I don't feel comfortable. I'm not an expert. It's okay. And it's commonplace to ask for help from our friends and send these patients to psychiatrists and sexual therapists. That's very common practice.
Sure. Absolutely. And, you know, the other thing is pain. And we all say, if you're having pain, then, you know, of course you're not going to have an increased libido. Why would you want to participate in sexual activity if it hurts? So that's a big area of our practice, you know, looking at what's happening to those vaginal tissues because of lack of estrogen. Who can we treat? Who can we not treat? what's happening with the pelvic floor, because so many times if you have pain, you know, the vulva, you're going to contract that pelvic floor. And when patients go through radiation, if they have pelvic radiation, you know, then we're working with vaginal stenosis. You know, our PT colleagues are a big part of our team, you know, in terms of how do we use dilators? How do we get that vaginal mucosa integrity improved so that they can begin to use the vaginal dilators? And there's so much fear of what's going to happen the first time I have sex and how do we help them navigate that? I actually have an acrylic dilator. We have acrylic dilators in our rooms, our patient rooms. And oftentimes when I feel that the integrity of the vaginal mucosa is good, you can actually put the dilator in and you can say, here, look, you actually do have vagina. This is your vagina. And they're like, wow.
Which is wonderful.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't have access to sexual health women's experts like yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So if a patient is having genital pain, particularly vulvar pain, would they traditionally or typically seek help from a gynecologist, from an internist, from a dermatologist, from a plastic surgeon? I mean, who do you feel in the general medical community is best able to address that kind of pain?
I think oftentimes, you know, when you have a gynecologic cancer, you're working with a gynecologist, but it really depends on who's the expert in your community. Like here at Mayo, we're in the Division of Internal Medicine, which is unusual, you know, and our colleagues from gynecology, we work with them all the time. And so there's a very collaborative environment here, but out in the community, it becomes really difficult. So, you know, we've been discussing this, how do we help our patients get to people who are experts in the community? And so people who are certified by the Menopause Society, you know, we're going to start to provide a provider list for them so that, or at least access to, this is how you can find somebody, because a lot of people after the WHI trial still are like, oh my gosh, what do we do with the hormones? What is the information? Right, wrong? You know, and they're, of course, you know, physicians are worried about harm. They're afraid to actually do it. So that, and then ISHWISH is another large organization that has provider lists. And ISHWISH is an international sexual community, 2,000 members. It's a huge organization. And so there are people that have gone through multiple trainings in that environment as well. And so who are the people who know about these things and how can we get to them?
Well, thank you. That's very helpful references for our audience. I appreciate it. So let's talk about the medical side. Can women who have had hormone cancers use topical or systemic hormones? So if you have breast cancer or ovarian cancer or cervical cancer, et cetera, and you go through your treatment, are you allowed to have an estrogen pouch when you have all these perimenopausal or menopausal symptoms? Are you allowed to use topical creams in your vaginal area, like estrogen cream, to help with skin atrophy? What are the practicalities of hormone therapy?
So there are several publications that we refer to and look at, you know, with this particular type of cancer, what is the risk of recurrence if you would give somebody hormone therapy? So with breast cancer, the absolute answer is no. We don't get hormone therapy. The only time we do is in that very, very young patient who has BRCA1. And so they have their breasts up, their ovaries removed. And if they have a low-grade cancer, sometimes we will treat them. And certainly if they're BRCA and they have it prophylactically, absolutely we treat them. So women with ovarian cancer, you know, there are certain tumor types. So when we're looking at who we give hormone therapy, who we don't do, we look at what was the specific tumor type that they have and the stage. So that's really important, because in some cancers, like in uterine cancer, ovarian cancer, most of those tumor types in the early stages, we can treat, you know, there's limited data, but it does not appear that it would increase recurrence of that cancer. In later stages, then we do not. Then we have to think about what are the non-hormonal treatments that we can use for systemic treatment of vasomotor symptoms. There are medications on the market now that we certainly need to turn to. Paroxetine is an FDA-approved treatment for vasomotor symptoms. We frequently use that in women who are not on tamoxifen because it can decrease the efficacy. There's a new medication on the market that we're beginning to look at, Veosa. It is, the mechanism of action is actually in the brain that affects vasomotor symptoms. So vasomotor symptoms are caused by lack of estrogen that actually decreases the activity of this neurokinin B, And so when that's gone, the neurokinin B just, you know, has a great time and, you know, can cause all these vasomotor symptoms. So this specific one actually targets that. And so that's just come on the market. It's just FDA approved. And so it's expensive. That's a problem. You know, every time there's a new medication on the market, then the price is high. So we're kind of working with that. There's coupons and those kind of things. And, you know, there's other non-hormonal things that we can also use, like oxybutynin and gabapentin, that we kind of navigate and work with the patient to be able to choose which one might be best for them.
So I need to ask at this juncture then, for our patients who like naturalistic medicine, holistic medicine, Eastern medicine, are there other alternative options like a supplement, a vitamin, yoga, acupuncture?
It's interesting because the Menopause Society actually just published a paper on non-hormonal treatments and recommendations, but it's like the United States Preventive Services Task Force. They look at the data and where the data is. That doesn't mean you don't have to do it, but certainly we tell people that alcohol can stimulate vasomotor symptoms, caffeine can, does acupuncture work? There's not data that supports it, but that doesn't mean you can't do it. You know, and it may help other things because people get muscle tension, they get a lot of other things around it. Stress management, does that help? Probably not. But for some people, this is a stressful time. And so we offer stress management. There is some data on hypnosis that that can help with decreasing hot flashes. And also cognitive behavioral therapy has been found to decrease vasomotor symptoms. The other thing that you were talking about that I wanted to address with topical estrogen. So even if you are not a candidate for systemic hormone therapy, oftentimes women can be a candidate for vaginal estrogen, even in our breast cancer patients. So we have a very nice model where we look at when did you get your cancer? What was your stage? What medications are you on endocrine therapy? How long ago was your therapy? And so we can kind of walk through who is a good candidate for estrogen and who's not. And so we always treat with moisturizers first, and moisturizers are really quite remarkable at helping with the vaginal mucosa. So after 12 weeks, you're like, oh, we're going to give this 12 weeks. We're going to see how it works. Okay. So after they've used that and they come back and they're still having symptoms that it's really bothering them and they are having difficulty with their partner sexual issues. And we work with medical oncology and breast clinic all the time. And we make a decision together that yes, this person can have topical estrogen, or the person on aromatase inhibitors can have DHEA. So those are, you know, it's a navigable thing. You know, we have to, each patient is individual and how we approach that.
Well, thank you for circling back to that. And of course I'm smiling because as a dermatologist, I'm very supportive of using moisturizers here, there, and everywhere.
Yeah.
And moisturizers are different than lubricants because lubricants go in the canal and moisturizers go on the outside.
Right. We have a lovely handout that we get, in fact, we have lots of handouts. So that one handout that we have, it actually shows where, because people will come in and they'll say, I abandoned the estrogen cream because it was messy. And I said, well, throw the applicator away. And so our nurses who are awesome come in and show them, you know, this is how you do it. You just put a little bit on your finger and then you're going to massage it. Just like we kind of say, you know, it's like your other face, you know, and you
yes.
treat it like that.
Yes, I call it upstairs, downstairs. We are moisturizing and cleansing upstairs, but we're not comfortable with doing it downstairs, but it's very, the principles are similar.
Yes, for sure.
So speaking of dermatology, as a dermatologist, I use lasers all the time.
Uh-huh.
And there's uses for laser in for these patients, but we don't use lasers in the same way. So do you want to talk about lasers and sexual health?
Sure. So there have been some studies specifically in breast cancer. After 2 years, it seemed like things were helpful. Another one was like they didn't see any difference over 6 months, you know, looking at those who got it and those who didn't. You know, they did sham in it for the population. The sham is like, it looks like you're doing the same thing, but you're really not. So people think they're getting it and they're not. And then they followed them. The problem is we don't have long-term data on it. We can't say specifically that there's not going to be any harm from this because we don't know. And in talking with our urogynecologists who do the laser therapy, one thing that we've learned is if somebody really has a very thinned out vaginal mucosa, it's not going to work because it's just too thinned out. There's like this little time when you could use the laser and see if it gives some benefit. So I haven't used it a lot, but we're hopeful that ultimately that may be something that is useful, especially for our breast cancer patients.
And just for clarification, Carol, the laser is used on the outside or in the vaginal canal?
Just on the outside and a little bit in the vaginal canal, if I understand correctly.
Okay. And it's for vaginal atrophy in the mild to moderate stage, but not in the severe stage.
Yeah.
And it's a repetitive therapy, not a one-time therapy.
So they do it three times. And then the question on the table is then if you do it three times and they have response, would you do that on an annual basis? So that's all under study now to try and understand how this is all going to work.
Yeah, excellent. Well, and we had already talked earlier, you helped us with natural medicine, saying there's not much data on that either, but like meditation, yoga, cupping, massage, stress management, it doesn't hurt to do these things, correct?
Exactly.
See that. And you mentioned earlier pelvic floor therapy. So can you walk us through how you explain pelvic floor therapy to patients? Because it sounds like a very abstract concept.
Yes.
And it sounds like it's kind of intimidating. So what are the practicalities from the patient standpoint of what you're asking them to do? And is it helpful?
Sure. As a team, we approach this and we have a model of the pelvic floor. So we can actually show them, you know, after an exam, then I could say, okay, this is what I felt. So you can see where the vulva is. You can see that first set of muscles. And then you can see the deeper pelvic floor muscles. And so you can actually show them that those pelvic floor muscles surround the vagina, they surround the rectum, they surround the urethra. And so when they're tight, that actually causes not only pain, but urinary symptoms, bowel symptoms. And, you know, GI works with the pelvic floor all the time because of constipation issues. So we do that. And then we have a really nice handout that we developed on pelvic floor physical therapy so that the patient can take that and review it, the nurses review it with them. So they've already had a lot of instruction before they ever get to see the pelvic floor physical therapist.
And just to clarify, before we go into what the exercises are and how often and things, pelvic floor dysfunction in females, the patients think, I'm getting older, I've had pregnancies, I've had babies, now I've had cancer. And they consider the pelvic floor dysfunction to be atrophy, laxity, and prolapse. But actually, you're talking about the opposite problem. Scar tissue, fibrosis, and tightening.
Yes, exactly, exactly. So I tell them if your pelvic floor physical therapist tells you to do Kegels, it's the wrong pelvic floor physical therapist because they're already so tight like this, you know. And a lot of women will actually carry their stress in their pelvis. And so, you know, it's really tight when they're not even just in general. And so then we show them the dilators that they will use. And we try and prepare them and make sure that we work with the vaginal mucosa before they get there so that, you know, that the integrity of the mucosa is good. And because that'll cause pain and then they're just like out the door, they're not going to be doing it.
So pelvic floor therapy in this instance, because things are too tight and lifted too well, is dilation. It's not some sort of physical therapy exercise.
Right. But we can give them before they get to a pelvic floor PT, we actually do have some handouts that show yoga exercises that help the pelvic floor. So we have them start that while they're working on vaginal mucosa. And then at 3 months, we see them back, make sure everything's okay. In the meantime, they're already doing something to kind of help themselves. And sometimes when women are stressed about starting to have sexual activity, I'll just tell them, do these yoga exercises prior to sexual activity, you know, get yourself in a relaxed state. And so a lot of them will do that. And then we talk about, you know, the use of vibrators, which, because the thing with the vaginal mucosa is when estrogen is diminished, it decreases sensitivity, it decreases your ability to have an orgasm. Women will commonly say, it takes me longer, it's just harder, it's frustrating. And then we introduce into the concept of the vibrator, which increases the ability to have an orgasm. And some of them are just like, well, but we kind of thought, well, here, Mayo has the Mayo endorsed handout on vibrators and sexual health. And they're like, well, at Mayo? Yep. Mm-hmm. So we give that to them. We also won an award for our patient education handout on comfort during sexual activity, which has, you know, illustrations and it's very inclusive. And so that's another thing we can give them to help them in their journey.
That's excellent. Yes. And it's another taboo topic. So I'm glad that you brought that up.
Yes.
So moving on, I want to make sure that we take time to talk about healthcare disparities. and things that are unique to certain demographics of patients. Is there anything in particular that we need to be aware of with regards to this topic, addressing people who are non-white, so the skin of color community and ethnic and racial minorities?
Absolutely. I mean, screening is a huge thing, of course. We want to make sure that everyone is getting screened properly. But the one thing that I did come across when I was giving my lecture yesterday was that in women who are Black, there seems to be a higher incidence of uterine cancer, and they seem to have a higher incidence of recurrence with hormone therapy. So it's kind of like, all right, we need to take a time out and figure out where this patient is, what their stage was, and if it's going to be safe for that patient.
Yeah. And then also another minority demographic, can you talk about this concept with regards to the LGBTQIA population?
Sure. You know, in our clinic, unfortunately, we haven't seen a lot of, and we do identify because we actually were the clinic who piloted the SOGI questionnaire. So that questionnaire was identifying, you know, gender identity. And so now at Mayo, that is enterprise-wide that everybody gets that questionnaire. So if we have a patient who is LGBTQT or trans, and then we talk about, you know, the dysphoria for trans patients and hormone therapy is always a question on the table. As far as the lesbian community, it seems that in my reading, while we haven't seen a lot of these patients, we certainly would welcome that, they seem to do better after their surgeries in terms of a sexual response and sexual recovery. And I don't know if that they're more open, you know, to their communication with their female partners, which might be helpful, I think, because I think maybe females are a little more reticent to talk to their male partners about sexual health. I think that's actually a good thing.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And any other concepts or topics or you want to talk about today?
Those are the main things. I mean, I think it's important for us, you know, as a group, when we approach these patients, that we're very mindful of what the literature shows in terms of hormone therapy. And we're very mindful about working with our colleagues to make sure we're all on the same page when we're, because there are sometimes when, like a patient who has metastatic breast cancer, that patient, maybe there'll be concerns about recurrence with vaginal estrogen, but you'd be surprised how many of them are concerned about what's happening with their partner and they want it. So it is a shared decision making process in terms of yes or no. And so sometimes where we might be concerned about recurrence, if this patient has metastatic cancer and she's really being distressed by this, we will treat them.
That's very helpful. Thank you. My name is Dawn Davis, and it's been my pleasure to host this Mayo Clinic Talks podcast about sexual health in the midst of a cancer journey with my colleague, friend, and expert, Dr. Carol Cool. Carol, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for inviting us, and thank you so much for concluding this topic.
Absolutely. So to our audience, we say thank you. We hope you subscribe to this podcast series. We appreciate your sharing your expertise with your patients, and thank you for the gift of your time.